We are going to be looking at 1 Timothy chapter 2, a portion of that chapter. And I want to put your minds at ease. Maybe it's at ease, I'm not sure. You'll notice it says on the screen, Defining Roles, Part 1. What that means is that we will not get through all that I had planned initially to try to get through because there's just too much here that needs to be dealt with. And I discovered as I was working away that I ended up with about 16 pages of notes, and usually I can get through about 5 to 6. And there's so much here, and this is a rather complex passage with lots of different things to deal with, and so I wanted initially to take it all together because it's kind of it all fits together, and that would be the better way to do it. But given all the other circumstances, we're gonna get through point one, okay? Is what I'm hoping for today. And so don't throw away your outline. Come back. We'll probably give you a new one next time anyway, but partly filled in with the section that we're doing for today. But just to give you some heads up on what we're going to try to accomplish today. Now, there is no shortage of challenges and difficulties for the church today, for anything today. I mean, it's a complex world. There are a lot of different things that we have to deal with. But also, that's the way it was with the church in the past. That's the way it's been with the church throughout the years. There's always lots of stuff to have to deal with. We are dealing with issues related to social norms. What's appropriate societally? We thought we knew what marriage was. We thought we knew what life was all about. But now those things are being, you know, significantly challenged. We thought we knew where the earth came from. We thought we knew how life began. We thought we knew where we're headed. All of those things are now up for grabs. There is a sense of apathy. It's like it's such a mess. We can't really do anything anyway. Let's just eat, drink, and be merry. You know, that's kind of the way it is. You look at politics, and you just get a little frustrated sometimes when you see the kinds of things that people think are wise decisions or whatever they're thinking. And then you deal with the whole issue of narcissism that we have created for ourselves, that we think that the world revolves around us. So there are issues, there are challenges today, but there were in the past as well. Because as we look at 1 Timothy, Paul is dealing with various problems and issues. Similarly, in the book of 1 Corinthians, and there's some overlap on some of the things that he's dealing with there. One of the things that we see in chapter 1 of 1 Timothy is that he addressed the problem of false teachers. In verse 3, he says, "As I urged you when I went into Macedonia, remain in Ephesus, that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine, nor give heed to fables and endless genealogies, etc." In other words, there were people there who were teaching things that weren't right, and that was a concern. And then he concludes the chapter and deals with a few other things in there, concludes the chapter. "This charge I commit to you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you may wage the good warfare, having faith and a good conscience, which some, having rejected concerning the faith, have suffered shipwreck, of whom are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I delivered to Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme." So there were some things going on in the background that needed to be dealt with. So we aren't the only ones dealing with problems that the church has to address. This is something that has been going on in the past as well. also indicated a need for prayer as a foundation for people to come to faith in Christ. This is what we saw previously, chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. If you want to focus on one verse, verse 4, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth, but previous to that, he said, therefore, I exhort, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. And then he goes on and gives some more detail. And he mentions the mediatorship of Christ. And the idea then is that we are to serve as mediators like Christ, under Christ, if you will, for the world, for the unsaved. And so we have a similar kind of responsibility. So he's essentially saying what he expects of them, but now he's going to move forward from there, and he's going to identify the manner in which such prayers should take place and why. So in verses 8 through 15, but we're only going to get through verse 10 today. So that's what we want to take a look at. And in the process, in verses 8 through 15, of identifying the manner in which such prayers should take place and why, he is going to communicate a very different focus for men and for women. And we kind of need to know what he's saying and why he's saying it. Because he's going to be identifying something as it relates to the roles of men and women in the church. And I don't know if you've noticed, but that's a pretty hot issue in the church today. What should the men do? What should the women do? Where is the overlap? How do we deal with that? How do we understand that? And there is a possibility that we may not all end up in exactly the same place in our understanding, ultimately, but what we need to look at is, what does the text say? What does the text mean? In other words, what did Paul mean for the church in Ephesus, where Timothy was at this time? And what does God mean ultimately for the church as it relates to the roles of men and women in the church? Now, if we can come to some understanding there, that would be helpful. But it's not easy. And so we have to try to deal with that. So there is no small amount of discussion and spilt ink over roles in the church. That has been an issue, and it's one that we need to be able to take some time and give consideration to, which is part of the reason why I thought we need to go through this slowly enough to make sure that we have time to try to hopefully absorb and understand what is here. So the manner of presentation before God and man is what I'm calling verses 8 through 10, essentially. The manner of presentation, the way in which we come before God in prayer, and the way in which we do so before man. What is involved here? So verses 8 through 10. I desire, therefore, that the men pray everywhere. And that is not the generic mankind. It's not anthropos. It's the aner, andros, which is the men, males. I desire, therefore, that the men pray. And it's the men. It actually has an article on that, because often in the original it may not have an article, and you supply it in English because they may not necessarily need it, so that when there is one there, there's a good reason for it. So, I desire therefore that the men pray everywhere, or literally it's in every place, but has the idea of everywhere, hence it's translated that way in the New King James, lifting up holy hands. And the question is, is that a command? Is that what we're supposed to do when we pray? Are we supposed to hold our hands up? We kind of need to deal with that. Without wrath and doubting. Doubting is probably not the best translation there. We're going to look at that. In like manner also. And we need to look at, okay, what's in like manner relating to? That the women, it literally says, and that women, because it's doesn't have an article, but we supply it in English. So is there a distinction that's being made there? That women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now, is that a handful to deal with? I think so. So, we want to take a look at some of this. And the first is the question of why. Why is he dealing with these things? Where is this coming from? What is behind this? And it's often important for us to give some thought to the occasion and the purpose that someone writes, because there is always a reason why a biblical author writes. And when we think about the epistles, we refer to them as occasional documents. That is, they are written for a specific occasion. And therefore, there may be some specific things that deal with that specific location, that particular time, but that has principles that carry on to us. And we have to figure out, okay, which are the things that apply to just Ephesus in this case, in Timothy's working out, and which are those things that apply to the whole church all over at that time and all over at our time. So that's kind of what we need to try to keep in mind. One commentator titles this section, that is verses 8 through 15, "The Primary Responsibilities of the Men and the Women in Church Meetings." In church meetings. So right there, he's narrowing the focus just a little bit. Is that indeed what is the case? He writes, "In this paragraph, Paul continues his instructions on prayers begun in verse 1. But now the concern is the proper demeanor on the part of the prayers," those who are doing the praying. What ought to be their demeanor? And so we have some question as to why. Why are these concerns? Why is this being brought up? Why is it dealt with in this way? And why is there so much more time in these verses spent on the women than on the men? There's one verse dealing with the men, and the rest of it is dealing with the women, essentially, though it has some implications. And what's helpful to realize is that this section, chapter 2, is preparatory to chapter 3, which is dealing with leadership in the church. You can't miss that, because it's got to have some application and implications here. So the solution, as it relates to the why here, I believe, again, comes down to the issue of the false teachers, of something that was going on in the context of Ephesus that required something to be stated to deal with this matter here. So the word to the men here seems to be an obvious response to some controversies and strife, given the words that are used in verse 8. It says, "I desire therefore that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting." That word doubting there is dialogismos, the emphasis on the last syllable there. It has the idea of argument or discussion. You see our word dialogue in that word. That's where we get our word dialogue. Dialogismos. And it would be anger and argument, if you want to put it another way, without wrath, doubting. Let me just go through how some of the different translations have put this. The New King James, the King James, and the AV of 1873 translate it doubting. Why? I'm not exactly sure, because I don't really see that in the word, other than if they're seeing something that I just don't see. The NRSV translates it argument. The New Living Translation translates it controversy. The LAB translates it dispute. The NIV, disputing. The NASB 95 edition is dissension. The ESV, quarreling. And that word can also have, it can be a negative or it can be a positive. In the positive, it's reasoning. You dialogue, you reason. So, but when you put it with the word orge or wrath or anger, then you see, well, and you look at it in terms of the context, then it seems to be probably argumentation, quarreling, dissension, that idea seems to be there. More so than doubting. Doubting maybe the idea of just not having sufficient confidence or whatever, but I don't think that's really what's at issue there. So the word to the women here then, as it's going to pick up in verse 9, in like manner also that the women adorn themselves, what's the connection? What's the in like manner? We're going to have to look at it in a moment. So it assumes also that there was a conflict that they were dealing with. And there's something going on in the church or the churches at Ephesus that warrant this particular instruction. And so what we need to see here is that there is a corrective element. It's not simply prescriptive, saying, okay, this is the way things ought to be. It's saying there's something wrong here and this needs to be addressed. It needs to be fixed. And sometimes when something is wrong that needs to be fixed, it may be overstated for emphasis in order to bring it back to where it needs to be. So keep that in mind. But there was a problem. And again, there's a relationship between this passage and 1 Corinthians 11 and 14, which also was definitely, I mean, the whole book of 1 Corinthians is dealing with problems in the church. So there were issues going on there. So, first of all, we want to look at what are the expectations for the men in this case. That's the first thing that is dealt with, expanding on this idea of praying. So, recognize the context in view. What is the context? Again, I've already mentioned, it says in verse 8, I desire therefore that the men pray everywhere, and again I said it was literally in every place. It'd be nice if that were defined, wouldn't it? Are we talking about every place in Ephesus? Are we talking about every place in the world? Are we talking about every place that Christians assemble in congregations? Is that what's in view? Or is it just talking about men everywhere? Well, it would be good if men everywhere were to pray. But is it perhaps talking about the local context of the church? Again, coming back to chapter 3, verse 15, and you kind of have to come back to this a time or two. When you look at the focus of this passage, what comes before and what comes after, it seems to validate the idea that this is related to the places where people assemble as congregations as it relates to the makeup of the church. Chapter 3 and verse 15 says, "But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." So if you aren't sure what he's talking about there, so it relates to the house of God, which is the church of the living God, is pretty clear. That's the context that he's dealing with. So that does help narrow it down some. So he's talking about instructions for local church meetings. However, it may have a broader application than just the church assembled, but we don't know for sure or what the nature of that is, exactly what that looks like. But the idea seems to be this. If we could pick up one principle here, it's that typically men should take the lead in praying. Because that's what he's saying here. That's what the emphasis is. And when you look at the whole context, that seems to be the case. In the context of the church assembled, that's the idea. But it probably would not have upset Paul if a woman led in prayer occasionally. When you look at 1 Corinthians 11, 5-16, where it talks about the women there praying with their head covered, or, you know, having hair, which is a symbol of their being in a place under the authority of the men who were to be leading, in particular as it related to their husbands in the context of 1 Corinthians 11. So assuming they are the women are under the authority of the male leadership, then that probably would have been acceptable in the right context, but the major emphasis is the men ought to take the lead. And we generally try to do that. And as we'll see, there is a created order, and that created order, because that's what he talks about in 1 Corinthians 11, that's what he's going to talk about in this passage as well, when we get down to verses 13 and 14. And so we need to consider exactly what is entailed with that. But it has implications in the church. But what's not clear is what are the implications outside the church? Does it have implications outside of the context of the church? Well, we know what the expectations are in the Christian home. Who is to take the lead? Who is to have responsibility there? That doesn't mean that he's the only one that can, but he's the one who has responsibility in the context of the home, the husband of the home, assuming there is one, and there isn't always one. And then the question is, should we apply these instructions to meetings of parachurch organizations where it's not the church, or is it the church? It is the church universally, but it's not the church officially locally. And so we have to take that into account. And again, I think you have to look at, okay, what's the context? Who is responsible for what here? Does it still fit the basic principle that's being communicated? And does this apply in all other contexts? And we kind of need to look at that a little bit later in terms of, does the expectation for male leadership as it relates to prayer have implications in other contexts outside the church, outside Christendom, or not? And we'll have to look at that when we get to the later section here, the rationale that's going to be dealt with at the end of this passage, verses 13 and 14 and 15. So again, is there a guiding principle here? The roles and the order, what all is involved? One author writes this. He says, the use of the definite article with men and not with women in verse 10 may suggest that the apostle was laying down the pattern that public worship should be conducted by the men. That's the conclusion of at least one from looking at this. So there's at least seems to be a general expectation there. Then recognize the focus in view. Are we supposed to pray with our hands uplifted? And is it like this, or is it like this? Or is it like this, or like this? Which way? How do we do it? You need to think about those kinds of things when we look at a passage like this. The instructions here on how they should pray involves an emphasis on what? In other words, what is the emphasis? What is the focus? The emphasis is on the inner holiness and outward righteous behavior. This was not really a command to pray with upraised hands. Now, why do I say that? Well, we need to look at some things. What we need to recognize is that it was common public practice of the day to pray with the hands up. That was not an unusual practice. And I want to look at several passages from the Old Testament which give us a little bit of background here and think about this. 1 Kings 8:22. Then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the assembly of Israel and spread out his hands toward heaven in his prayer there. Verse 54. And so it was when Solomon had finished praying all this prayer and supplication to the Lord that he rose from before the altar of the Lord from kneeling on his knees and with his hands spread up to heaven. So is this saying that The norm is for us to be on our knees with our hands spread up toward heaven, and then we got to figure out how to hold our hands to get that right. Ezra 9:5. At the evening sacrifice, I arose from my fasting, and having torn my garments and my robe, I fell on my knees and spread out my hands to the Lord my God. Similar kind of thing. Now, we need to remember, when we're looking at these, where it's talking about on the knees or hands raised up, there's a whole lot of other passages that deal with other positions. Face down on the ground and all these other, so there's plenty of other, or sitting, a lot of other different positions are mentioned as well. So I'm just showing the ones where that specifically mentions this. Hear the voice, this is Psalm 28:2. Hear the voice of my supplication when I cry to you, when I lift up my hands toward your holy sanctuary. Psalm 63:4. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands to your name. Psalm 134:2, lift up your hands in the sanctuary and bless the Lord. Let my prayer be set, this is Psalm 141:2, let my prayer be set before you as incense, the lifting of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Now think about the imagery that is in view in just this passage. As the incense flows upward, it symbolized the prayers of the people going up to God. And therefore, the idea of holding up your hands was also the sense that it's coming up through me and it's going up to God. And so that's the imagery that's communicated there. Is there anything wrong with that? Not at all. So that's understandable. Lamentations 2:19, and then we'll look at 3:41 also. Arise, cry out in the night at the beginning of the watches. Pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift your hands toward him for the life of your young children who faint from hunger as at the head of every street. And then 3:41, let us lift our hearts and hands to God in heaven. There's a clue. Right there, again, lift our hearts and hands. Our hearts are the imagery of this is where our sensitivities are in relation to God. Now, we know that there isn't anything going on in our hearts except for blood being pumped. So, again, you've got to recognize there's some imagery here that pictures this, but that's how we kind of communicate it. It's actually going on inside your head. You're thinking. Hopefully we're thinking. And then our hands relates to what? That which we do. So one relates to your sensitivities. The other relates to that which is done. So then Isaiah 1:15, when you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear you. Your hands are full of blood. So here we see that the hands relate to that which is done. So when you look at what he's talking about in 1 Timothy chapter 2, we need to make the connection that maybe it's not just focused on what we're doing with our position, but what we're doing with our hands. And not just the imagery of lifting up, though that pictures something. It's picturing that we are offering what we do up to God, particularly when you put the word holy on there. I don't have hands full of blood, but I'm lifting up my hands to God. So that's part of what is in view. So the posture is really not the main issue. That was common. That was something that was done. So when he says this, he probably means more than to say, okay, this is the way you need to pray. Lift your hands. He's not saying that. He's saying when you pray, and the common form is lifting your hands, but what's really being communicated is how you're doing it, what's coming from the heart, and these hands ought to be holy, not hands full of blood. So something else to note here. This posture was also common in the pagan mystery religions of the first century, so it's not exclusive to the church. So the posture isn't just that's the way you do things in the church, because there were other pagan groups that did it as well. There were pictures on the walls in the catacombs and in other Christian art that show believers praying in this way. And commonly they raised their palms upward to heaven to symbolize the inner openness to God. So now you know how to do it. It's hands like this, okay? So, again, I'm being a little facetious there to say it's not about the hands and how you're positioning them. It's about the heart, and the hands may be symbolizing that. So you can do this with your hands. And so I don't technically have a problem with it. The question is, why am I doing it if I'm doing it in a congregation of people? When we were just away to Michigan, we visited church of a family member, and in that service there were several people who during the music, I don't know if they did it during the prayer because I had my eyes closed and I wasn't looking around to see what anybody else was doing, so, but there were people who raised their hands, and my question then is, why am I doing that? Am I doing it because it is a spontaneous sense of need to stand before God, or am I doing it because, hey, look, isn't this cool? Because I can raise my hands and it draws attention to me. So if I'm doing it to draw attention to me, then that's wrong, plain and simple. If I'm doing it because it's the compulsion of the Spirit to do so, then, well, I'm not one to say don't do what the Holy Spirit tells you to do, but make sure it's the Holy Spirit and not something else. So anyway, that's something for us to think about. It seems that Paul was not focused on the idea of physically lifting their hands, because that was normal anyway. The idea was on that the hands that they're lifting are holy. In other words, what kind of conduct are you having in your experience, and is it associated with anger and argument? Because that's part of the manner in which you're praying here. So don't get hung up on the physicality. Get hung up on what's going on inside of me. Because as we've already communicated, our hands symbolize what we do. And that's probably more what's in view here. Psalm 24:4 kind of communicates this when it talks about who may ascend to the holy hill. It says, he who has clean hands and a pure heart. So does that mean if you haven't washed your hands, you can't come to church? Jesus had something to say about that. You know, why don't your disciples wash their hands? Well, that's really not the issue. What's really the issue is what's going on inside here. The hands are less critical in that regard. Although we also know that washing your hands is a good thing to do for other reasons, health reasons generally. So Paul wanted the men to pray as they practice holiness in their everyday lives. So the point then is that posture in prayer does not render the prayer more or less effective, but it may reflect the inner attitude of the person praying. And what really is at issue is your relationships. Matthew 5:22-24, Matthew 6:12, 1 Peter 3:7 deal with this. Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Make sure you have your relationships right. That's more important than, am I on my knees with my hands raised up, and do I have them faced in the right direction, etc. So the issue is not posture, but disposition. That's the thing that we need to keep in mind. Now, see, look what time it is already. Where does the time go? The expectations for the women. We have a little bit more to say. The meaning of in like manner, we need to touch on. Is this also assuming in their praying or their disposition in praying? Is that what is in view? It may be. Or is it their disposition in the context of the local church as they're gathered? It may be that is in view. But just as the men had an issue with proper decorum and disposition, this anger and argument thing, so did the women, and apparently their dress, their attire, was something that was standing in the way of being able to stand before God with a pure heart. And so this seems to be Paul's concern in this regard. So then the issue of appearance, the responsibility of women in the church meetings needed more explanation. And so that's why there's more space given to the women here, because he's going to deal with the men more later. The point here of these verses is that works that express godly character should characterize Christian women more than the way they dress and groom themselves. Now, we appreciate that there is concern for those things, but is it the right kind of balance, and does one take more precedent over the other? So the contrast here is between works and wardrobe, if you want to put it in a simple form. But this does not suggest that external appearance is unimportant. One author writes this: some say, let some say what some will about Paul. He here states that women are to dress in good taste when they prepare to attend church. That's at least one person's perspective. That was Lenski, if you've read any of the commentaries. Another writes, and this is Hebert, he says, slovenliness in dress and appearance is unbecoming of a Christian woman. So there's at least some balance that seems to be suggested. You don't throw out any concern for how you appear, but you make it not the primary thing. So what should be noticed is one's Christ-like behavior more than one's clothes or hairstyle or any of the other externals. 1 Peter 3:3-4 reminds us of this. Says, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. So there's a disposition that's being communicated here. Then, the place of adornment. One commentator writes, the Christian woman is not to adorn herself with gold or pearls or expensive clothes so as to draw attention to herself. At worst, this is what the prostitutes did. At best, it shows pride and self-centeredness, both of which are contrary to the spirit of Christ. Such dress is especially unbecoming in church. Another commentator writes, the reason for Paul's prohibition of elaborate hairstyles, ornate jewelry, and extremely expensive clothes becomes clear when one reads in the contemporary literature of the inordinate time, expense, and effort that elaborately braided hair and jewels demand, not just as ostentatious display, but also as the mode of dress for courtesans and harlots. Others suggest that the problem was that of insensitive women who were flaunting their dress, their jewelry, their hairstyles, and whatever, in a way that hurt the feelings of the poor and disturbed the church. So, and I read some of those quotes so that you know it's just not me telling you this, so that so I can share the burden here. But James also communicates something of a concern about proper decorum and attitude in the church and the danger of partiality. James chapter 2 kind of makes that clear. And the idea is this: we don't want things of the externals to be a distraction to the things of God. And that's just simple balance. So there are some who take it to an extreme and say, okay, cover up the hair so that that's not an issue. Don't wear any jewelry. And, wear clothes that are all the same color, so it's just bland, so it doesn't draw attention. That's probably taking it a little too far, because then it becomes focused on the externals only, because you're obsessed with it. So again, there's this balance. So can we keep this in balance? Can we realize that how we dress and why may be more important than we realize? Then we need to conclude the emphasis on godliness, which comes out again at the end of verse 10. Rather than being overly focused on matters of adornment, rather focus on that which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. The emphasis here is that spiritual qualities should be the mark of a Christian woman, especially in the context of the meeting of the church together. And let's see if there's something else that I want to note before we wrap it up. One put it this way, he says, to put it simply, a woman's adornment lies not in what she herself puts on, but in the loving service she gives out. I think that's instructive. And another noted this. He said, perhaps Paul gave these instructions to the men in verse 8 and to the women in verses 9 and 10, partially to counteract the natural or fleshly tendencies in most males and females. Most men tend to be active, so it is important that they give attention to praying, which is more contemplative than active. Women like to look good, so they need to remember that good deeds are more important than good looks. So balancing those things is important. The issue then is, how do we present ourselves before God as we come to Him in prayer, and how are we presenting ourselves before others in the process, in the context of the local church? We need to focus on, okay, are my hands and my heart where they ought to be, as they ought to be? And the men should take the lead in showing how that ought to go. And we'll look at more of that next time when we look at part 2.